took property from five different people, then that is five different robberies. On the other hand, if the defendant became intoxicated and plowed into three pedestrians, that's one manslaughter or one negligent homicide, depending on how it's pled. If the defendant were, say, to break into someone's house with the intent to rape the occupant and was frightened away by the victim, for example, she resisted enough to frighten him away, you could charge both the burglary and the attempted rape. Then at the time of sentencing, the prosecutor would be faced with a somewhat Hobson-like choice of asking the judge to impose the sentence on the attempted rape charge, which would be a Class B felony, but probably more clearly defines the nature of the offense, or ask that the sentence be imposed on the burglary charge, a Class A felony that carries the maximum penalty of 20 years as opposed to 10 years. Under this bill, in that circumstance, there would be a conviction for both burglary in the first degree and attempted rape. So it addresses situations in which multiple statutes are violated during a single criminal episode, during which multiple victims are injured or suffer loss, or the same victim is repeatedly violated in terms of the same statute, the rape and assault sort of situation.
Okay, I guess I'm still looking, is the merger then, does that come from the fact it was both the 20-year and the 10-year sentence? I mean, maybe there isn't a clear definition of merger. Maybe that's the problem.
Well, actually, just the use of the term merger is a legal misnomer, because merger really has a much narrower legal definition, but we use it kind of sloppily to talk about this. Those are situations in which the court has clearly said, we don't know whether the legislature intended us to enter convictions for burglary 1 and attempted rape 1. So we're going to, not knowing what the legislature intended us to do, we're going to apply the rule of lenity. And the rule of lenity says, one conviction, and the prosecutor gets to choose on which of the charges the conviction will be entered.
Thank you.
Okay, are there further questions? Comments on this bill? Okay, I'm going to ask counsel to, the amendments that have been prepared or were prepared as amendments of 2126, I'm going to have it redrafted to delete the victim notification provision and just focus on the consecutive and anti-merger portions and have those clearly delineated as amendments to 2331, and then go ahead and reschedule this for a work session on Wednesday for Subcommittee 1 and hopefully be able to take action at that time. Representative Kopetsky, I hope that your staff will have had time to prepare that spreadsheet and delineate the issues and what our choices are, and to the extent that you and Mr. Sandrock want to work together on that or confer in its preparation, that will be certainly appropriate. So are there any further instructions to staff or requests for information as we anticipate that final work session, we hope, on the proposal on Wednesday? Anything to add? If not, well, go ahead, Ms. Sandrock.
The 257 has had a public hearing on the Senate side at this point. Certainly the advantage of amending it into 2331 is that this body will have time to fully deliberate on it and send it back in the other direction. if there were a Senate bill over here that were appropriate for doing that, would the committee wish to consider putting 257 in that Senate bill and sending it back the other direction?
Well, I think we'll probably choose the House bill route first. That, not to say that if the House bill later finds its way into problems, then the other option may be available. But I'd prefer at this point to go ahead and deal with the House bill first.
All right. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Let's go with 244. My understanding, the parties have had a chance to resolve their differences. Major Madsen, Mr. Weaver, anyone else wish to join us?
Chairperson, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Reginald Madsen, part of the state police. I have had the opportunity to discuss the hand-engrossed bill submitted at the last hearing with a representative of the Cordova Police Department. At this time, I have that representative here, and they support the bill as written. They have one concern that he might want to address at this time.
Okay, Mr. Wanger.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Scott Wanger from Portland Police. We do support the bill as the hand and gross version that Major Madsen delineated at the last hearing. We do have one additional issue that we'd like you to approach, and if this means that it slows the bill down, we're not married to this to a point where we want to stand on this so firmly that it would kill the legislation. We like the idea of the bill. We like the way that the state police has worked with us in making the bill, but we would like one more issue addressed, and I'll leave it up to the discretion of the committee whether or not they feel that would slow the bill down or whether they will have time to address that. The issue we'd like addressed is the confidentiality of the information. What we'd like is a real clear statement that would express the intent of the committee that this information is solely to aid law enforcement as a tool in detecting serial type killers, and that we can maintain the confidentiality of ongoing investigations without compromising that by providing some of the details to a third party, in this case LEDS, and that we can maintain the control over confidentiality of that information. So essentially we'd like just a clear statement in the bill that the information will be provided to LEDS exclusively for their analysis and comparison, and that any referrals will be made from one agency to another. In other words, that this particular law enforcement agency is working on a case similar to yours, you should contact Investigator Smith or whatever. And so the actual details of the case are kept in strict confidence.
Okay. Let me just pose a question along that line. It's my understanding of the public records law, as long as the case is under investigation, any criminal activity, it is protected. It's not subject to public disclosure. As I read the amended bill, we're not talking about, and Major, feel free to correct me, it seems like we could be talking about bills which have, homicides which have actually been closed out in terms of being solved, and they're still in the computer because there's a tracking for a similar MO. Is that correct?
Yeah, say a solved homicide. I think that you're absolutely right there. I think his concern is that if they're doing an unsolved homicide, that they're investigating, they don't want that information to get out. Am I correct in that?
That's correct.
Scott, I think we can deal with your concern rather than hold the bill up any longer and try to come up with language.
I think we can, during floor debate or in committee and full committee, make sure there's a clear record in terms of what we mean on this. If that seems appropriate to you also, Major, that would be...
Yes, sir.
Okay. I only have one other question. This is one that council's going to have to resolve, and that is, I don't know if it's a big problem or just a little problem. We are generally extremely wary of amending relating clauses, and though I think yours is probably a technical amendment and would not be objectionable to anyone here, I am going to have to ask our council to confer with our chief clerk, because I know you want to delete the word unsolved homicide in the relating clause. And again, our rules are pretty strict about when that is or is not appropriate. It tends to come down pretty much against relating any substantive portion of the relating clause. Representative Kapelski?
Mr. Chair, there wouldn't be any, I mean, there is no need to delete unsolved, is there?
Yeah, you wouldn't really have to. You could put unsolved and solved.
I don't think we can add any words either. That kind of is the same problem. I think the relating clause, it's not a part of the law. It's, I think if we leave it intact, we're not going to run any problems, and that's probably the path of least resistance, to tell you the truth. Since, in a sense, we are talking about unsolved murder, we're talking about solved murders too, but rather than amend it, I think if we just left it as it is, if that's okay with you, that'd probably get us out of any problems.
Mr. Chairman, my understanding is the only reason that we're including solved homicides is for the sake of the unsolved homicides. So I think we're the total picture is still intact by using the term unsolved homicide.
Okay. Any further questions, Representative Phillips?
Back page of the bill, Major, it says when the homicide has been cleared, what actually do you mean by that?
Have to be an arrest and a conviction, or it'd never be solved.
Well, it says when the homicide has been cleared. Is that, I assume, common police parlance that they know exactly what that means?
I would hope so, yeah. I suppose we'd have to leave some of the bill up to the Lens Advisory Committee probably be formed on the unsolved, but yes, cleared means arrest and convicted.
Okay, any further questions? We could, Representative Phillips, try to add some language that would make it clear when the homicide has been cleared by arrest or conviction. Or arrest and conviction, although I don't know if you keep a case on until there's actually been a conviction or if an arrest is sufficient for some purposes. I'm not sure. It's really...
Well, I would submit that if we could say has been cleared by arrest, conviction, or action resulting in the termination of investigation, I mean, we could say just that, and that would address it. Perhaps so, Mr. Chair, and we could move that out conceptually.
Sure.
I would be more than happy to work to get some language for full committee so that that's no longer in the air. And I would also be more than happy to work with you to come up some language with regard to the confidentiality issue, if that was a big concern of the committee.
Okay, why don't we deal conceptually with Representative Phillips' amendment on page 2, line 1. Representative Phillips is moving conceptually that after the word cleared, we use language by arrest, comma, conviction, or other appropriate action. And we'll leave that somewhat open to allow you, Representative Phillips, to work with the sponsors and council to come up with language by Wednesday, possibly Thursday, I would hope, and we can have this back up. Or, assuming favorable action, subcommittee today, we could hear it as soon as Wednesday if we can get the amendment.
I'll have it ready by Monday.
Okay. Representative Phillips so moves. Is there any objection to that amendment? If No, it's adopted. And Representative Phillips, without making a motion at this time, if we think that some further language is necessary as it relates to the confidentiality...
I'm not convinced that it is.
We'll leave that option to the sponsors if they want to try to work something out with council to be presented to the full committee. That's fine. I agree with you. I think a clear statement of history is probably going to be sufficient, but if we can't find the language, it's not going to clutter it up. Since we're making changes anyway, it's got to go back for concurrence. It should be okay. So I think at this point, unless there's further comment or discussion, Representative Phillips, would you like to move the bill as amended to the full committee?
I certainly would.
Okay. Representative Phillips, in the Senate Bill 244 as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there further discussion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
Dusty.
Aye.
Peterson.
Aye.
Phillips.
Aye.
Aye. Motion's adopted. Thank you very much, folks. And if
Thank you
could sort of make sure that our council knows how to get a hold of you up until Wednesday, and then we'll consider the bill at full committee with one or two amendments as appropriate.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Appreciate your help. Okay. 2429 and 3006. We continue those bills in order to allow for the preparation of fiscal impact statement. And I think I've indicated earlier that each measure had significant potential fiscal impact. And though we don't have, unfortunately, it being a state holiday, I don't think we have or are able to get a hold of the folks who may have assisted or may have proposed these. Mr. Kornbrough has asked to have a moment to respond to the fiscal impact, since on their face it would appear that it would require one and or both measures, however we're going to deal with them, to go down to Ways and Means Committees.
I cite Kornbrough, the Federation of Oregon Patrol and Probation Officers. I looked at this fiscal impact, the first thing I was just appalled on both of them. And secondly, when I looked at them, I realized that they're a dream world. They have no rational basis in reality. We have, looking at 2429, we have an allocation of resource formula in the corrections division. What that means is cases are classified from a type 1 to a type 4 depending on the intensity of supervision, and then there is a work hour allocation for each type of case. A type 1 has a 5-hour work hour allocation down to a 0.6 of an hour for a type 4. A caseload is made up of 121.8 hours. The balance of that of the officer's time is allocated to non-case related items, training, administrative duties, and the like. Summarize this, to get 26.5 full-time equivalent positions out of 821 cases, the average case would have to be classified at something point of 3.9 hours, which is above, higher than a type 2. Now, the way we work our classification, it's a very complicated formula, but the length of time under supervision also goes to reduce the level of supervision. Most of our parolees and sex offenders are out doing a year now, so we are considering adding 4 more years to their parole. Those people who are doing well are generally 3s or 4s. The longer they're out, I haven't seen anybody who has been out more than 2 years who is anything above a 4. Because if they are, they're in trouble. they're back. A type 3 has 2 hours a month. A type 4 is 6/10 of an hour a month. It would seem to me that a much better assumption, and this is off the top of my head without really, tracking everything down, would be about an average of 1 8-work hour per month, which would be about 6 caseloads instead of 26 caseloads. So it's about a quarter of their estimate. And I just don't understand how anybody realistically could go over to the corrections division and make an assumption that the great majority of these people would be in at a very high level of supervision after the year that they are doing now. What we want them for is to keep track of them for the LEDS purposes. And that's basically a minimal level of supervision. I have 3 sex offenders on my caseload. I do not carry a specialized caseload. They're probationers. But they're all type 4s, and one of them is a rape case. He's been on for over three years, and he's a type 4, and that's an offense of 86, which boosts the way we figure it's offense, severity, criminal history, the history risk score, and there are points deducted for misbehavior in both relation to special and general conditions. I can bring to the committee at some point the full formula and show how we arrive at it, but I don't know where somebody got this, but just a cursory look at this, it just doesn't seem to bear a reasonable relationship to the system that I work in and what my members work in. As far as 3006, there are 2 things. Well, first of all, I do have an amendment that we have offered. Yes, Stevie Remington of the ACLU indicated some problems with the bill where somebody could be revoked based on a deceptive polygraph, so we offered that amendment. I don't think we do revocations based on a deceptive polygraph, but I think it probably is a good idea to put that into the code so that there is no question that that will not be the sole basis for anybody's revocation on either probation or parole.
So I'm going to ask a technical question.
Sure.
And I don't know if this is the only copy we've got. It's my understanding that you and the ACLU have agreed on this.
Yes,
that's right.
That is correct.
So we'll have these prepared as LC amendments before our next hearing, which I think will be Thursday on these 2 bills plus Representative Hill's bill. But on this amendment, if there is a deceptive response to a polygraph exam, what happens?
Generally, if that is all that we have, is a deceptive, we check it out. We go, then we start doing some legwork. That's assuming the person still denies. 2 things. Polygraph could be bad, and there could be a deceptive response because of person's nervousness. Well, a number of reasons. That's why a polygraph isn't just admitted. Or it could be that there is some fire with the smoke, and then it's up to us to investigate and work on it and see if there's anything that we can find out. And it's a tool. It's not a be-all and end-all. And as I think we indicated before, in most of the cases, the people admit prior to getting on the polygraph if they have a problem.
So it's my understanding that state police have some individuals who are trained in administering.
Yes.
Perhaps some of the larger law enforcement agencies do as well. And I'm aware there are people who do this who are private vendors. How does parole and probation, are there some parole and probation officers who are qualified to administer, or is this done on a contract, or?
It's usually in the metro, Portland metropolitan area, most of us use Ken Simmons, who is probably considered one of the really top people. One of the things, and I wanted to discuss that in relation to the money thing, what happens is, if it's private, which most of it is, it's a charge of $75 per examination. Some of the people that we have can afford $25 a month. They put it away and we do have an examination. If somebody cannot afford a polygraph examination, we do not give them quarterly examinations. What we do is If there is a suspicion of criminal activity, we will then go to the police, and the police who are investigating it will do the polygraph for nothing for us as part of their investigation. But I see here that they were talking, I mean, I couldn't believe this. If state funding is not available and treatment of polygraph tests are required of individuals who cannot pay, revocations will increase. Now, how in the world can anybody think that somebody will be revoked for a non-willful violation of probation? That's what that is. You know, you got to be willful to be in violation of probation, and an inability to pay is not a willful violation. I think, you know, basically, everybody who's in the system knows that. You just can't go and say, well, you couldn't pay for the polygraph, we're going to take you off to prison. That's, I mean, it's just, you know, it's incredible when I read a statement like that in a report. We do find that where they're talking about fewer of the offenders would be able to pay for treatment or polygraph, that's probably true with non-sex offenders, with burglars, thieves, general, check artists, people like that. That is not true with most of our sex offenders, especially those on probation, are middle class. I will check with our unit, our sex offender unit, but every one of them told me that they have little problem. Most of these people have jobs and have been employed for considerable, have good work histories and have considerable job experience and are able to pay. But I can assure you, if they can't pay, we don't haul them back to court because they couldn't pay. We go along as best we can using the tools we have. And I have no particular problem with making ability to pay a condition for a self-paying evaluation, if you want to spell it out, but I think that it's inherent in any condition for a willful violation of a condition, it can't be because you couldn't afford it. There's not a debtor's prison in this state.
I appreciate, and I think you're suggesting something reasonable for us to consider as possible amendments. I just get a little concerned about equal protection arguments when you start talking about treating someone who can pay differently from someone who can't. I think you obviously share that same concern.
I certainly do, but I think that when we talk about people whose actions are relatively clandestine, that they are not out on the streets like most of the offenders we know, where we basically have the police monitoring them for us, that it is not unreasonable to say if you wish a grant of probation or if you wish parole and you can afford to pay, you will be treated. Some of the people who can't afford to pay, we are able to get in treatment through government grants. There are mental health grants that are available. The Corrections Division has no money for treatment and polygraph, and yet we have had treatment and polygraph conditions imposed by individual courts for a long time. And we have not run into this tremendous money problem with the sex offenders. We can generally, the people in those units can scrounge up, if it were, free treatment on the treatment basis and polygraph by exception for those who can't pay for regular ones. And we've been relatively successful on that.
Okay, are there further questions from Mr. Kornbrook? If not, I know that the sponsors of this measure certainly are probably somewhat taken aback by the fiscal impact. And in order to allow them an opportunity to confer with Corrections Division and ask Corrections Division to come back to respond to some of the points that have been raised, we're going to reschedule these bills both for work session on Thursday. Are there any further questions?
1:30 on Thursday.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Any further questions or information about those two bills? Any further business to come before the subcommittee? Okay, if not, we'll be adjourned.